Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грег О'Лиар.
I'm Greg O'Lear. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. The writer and director of The Big Short, Vice, and Don't Look Up, Adam McKay is here. Thrilled to have him on the show. Before we get to Adam, I'm recording this on Thursday morning. It's June 9th at just about 8 o'clock a.m. Tonight, we're going to have the first televised January 6th hearing. Network TV, primetime TV, all the major news networks are going to cover it, except for Fox, because they're all a bunch of fascist assholes. Basically, this is going to be, I hope, a big TV event. And when you're listening to this, it's Friday morning. It will already have happened. I cannot predict the future. I cannot talk about that. I'll be talking about it Friday night on the 5-8, which is the YouTube show, the live YouTube show that I do with my friend LB. If you want to hear what I have to say about that, please tune in. It's on YouTube. It's called the 5-8, F-I-V-E, and the numeral 8. We'll be talking all J6 tonight. But right now I can't because it hasn't happened yet. What I can talk about is June 9th, because today's June 9th, which means it was 6 years ago that Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort met at Trump Tower with Natalia Veselnitskaya and other surrogates of Vladimir Putin. Why did that meeting take place? Because Jr. thought that the Russians had dirt on Hillary Clinton. They didn't have dirt on Hillary Clinton. At least we don't think they had dirt on Hillary Clinton. We never saw it. However, they had the meeting anyway, thinking that there was going to be dirt on Hillary Clinton. It wound up they were talking about adoptions, which was really shorthand for sanctions being lifted. And a lot of it had to do with her railing against Bill Browder, who she hates, as far as we know. That's what we've been able to say. Now, you'll recall the meeting happened on June 9th, 6 years ago today. It took about a year before we found out about the meeting. New York Times broke the story. And then Junior tweeted out the emails, which is really funny. It's stupid. But, you know, it's Junior. Mueller declined to press charges against Junior, did not indict him. And the thinking was that he was so dumb that he didn't realize what he was doing was a crime, which isn't really a thing, but whatever. So 6 years on, the perpetrators remain at large. These guys tried to have Russia help them find dirt on a candidate for president. And, you know, they went along with it happily. What did Junior say? If it happens later in the summer, I'd love it. Nothing happened. So, you know, maybe the balance will swing back. Maybe today, tonight, this hearing, the pendulum swing will start to swing back towards justice a little bit, I hope. You know, no pressure, just the fate of democracy rests on it. Anyway, moving on. Adam McKay was so thrilled that he agreed to come on my show he started following me on Twitter, I don't know, a couple of years ago now, which was really exciting for me, just that he followed me on Twitter. I'm a big fan of his work. I just think just his aesthetic and the way he tells stories just, you know, just resonates with me. It's just, it's so creative and clever. And he's taken on big topics. You know, he's telling these expansive stories and he's doing it really well. And if you haven't seen any of his movies, that he does this thing where, you know, there's a lot of people talking to the audience directly, which isn't something that you see that much in films, more on the stage. There's like, you know, cameos that are used for effect just to tell the story. Like in The Big Short, he has like Margot Robbie is just in a bathtub sipping champagne talking about some financial thing to get you to pay attention to it. Anthony Bourdain is in that as well, like cutting up a fish talking about something to do with finance. And you're watching this whole thing and it's just brilliant the way that he puts all this stuff together. So, you know, Big Short obviously is great. Don't Look Up is great. I think everyone's seen it at this point. We have a nice chat about that movie in particular. I think Vice is the one of the three that's the least well known, but it might actually be my favorite. I keep wanting to call it Veep, but it's Vice, and it's the story of Dick Cheney. It's like a Dick Cheney biopic, and it's brilliant. Christian Bale plays Dick Cheney, and it might actually be my favorite of the three. It's a really good movie. If you haven't seen it, I encourage you to check it out. But he's done a lot of other things before that. He wrote for SNL, as he talked about. He even did a little stand-up back in the day. He wrote Anchorman and Step Brothers, which is a really funny movie. And he's an executive producer of Succession, which is, you know, the best show on TV. And he has a new show called Winning Time, which he's also producing and helped kind of. It's a very Adam McKay looking show. It's about the Showtime Lakers, the Magic Johnson, Kareem era. It's really, really fun. I'm a big basketball guy. I enjoyed the hell out of it. My wife is not, and she also really liked it. So, you know, if you want something that is entertaining and also has nothing to do with all the horrors going on in the world right now, that's a really fun show to watch on HBO called Winning Time. So yeah, I was really thrilled that Adam came on. Like I said, I'm a big fan of his. I think I tried to curb my gushing. I think I did a good job curbing the gushing. So, you know, but I'll gush now. He's great. I really just like just about everything he does. So he's working on some new things. I'm excited for those to come out. And okay, I'm at the 6 minute mark. Enough of my prattle. We'll be right back with Adam McKay.
Remember that old parlor game, Two Truths, One Lie?
When I think of an alpha man, the first guy that comes to mind is Josh Hawley.
In our new and improved version, there's a little twist.
COVID-19 was made in a lab in China.
All three statements are lies.
Hillary Clinton had Vince Foster murdered to cover up the truth about the Clinton Foundation.
Milton Bradley presents a new icebreaker game for the GOP.
Donald Trump and JFK Jr. are secretly tracking down a covert cabal of Satan-worshipping elites who run a child sex ring and control our politics and media, and the skeleton key to unlocking it all is on Hunter Biden's laptop.
Alternative Facts, the Republican Party game. Perfect for all your MAGA gatherings, Trump rallies, war on Christmas parties, Civil War reenactments, CPAC conventions, prayer breakfasts, and red state screenings of Top Gun Maverick. Alternative Facts, the Republican Party game, is available wherever guns are sold. And now, back to the show.
Adam McKay, welcome to the Prevail Podcast.
Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
So as we started, it was revealed that you were in Ireland writing, which is fantastic because it's a fantastic thing to be doing. And also I'm excited for whatever it is you're writing to be completed and that we can see it. But now, are you scoping out places to leave if the United States collapses? Is that what brought you to Ireland or?
Well, you know, I've always loved Ireland. I've been coming here. I think the first time I was here was 1995 with Will Ferrell, Dave Koechner, and a friend of mine, writer-director Tom Janis. And obviously, with a name like McKay, I'm Scotch-Irish, and then my mom's side is even more Irish. And I've just always loved it. And we have friends in Dublin who are writers and theater directors, and it's a beautiful country. So, Yeah, we bought a house here about 3 years ago, and I come out here to write. It's where I wrote Don't Look Up.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. I am not Irish, and I've never been to Ireland. People want to put the apostrophe in my last name and make me Irish all the time, but it's just...
O'Lair.
Yeah, yeah. It's just not what it is. You know, I can't do it. So, okay. So I want to cover a bunch of different things about your career and about the political scene now and about comedy and satire and the state of it all now. So you came up as a comedy writer, as a comedian, and your early work is pretty much a straight up, you know, comic fare. And then you did kind of this pivot, which is really hard to do, I think, right? So with The Big Short and with Vice, I always want to call Vice Veep, by the way, if I get through this without doing that, you know, if I do it, that's why. And obviously Don't Look Up, what you mentioned, you've retained all the funny stuff, but the films are a lot more ambitious. So what made you decide to go this route rather than just staying in your lane, or just the natural evolution of things, or?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think people think with comedy, oh, it's, you know, you get laughs and it's a good time. But, you know, underneath a lot of the comedy that we love, it is real stuff about the world. So when I was in Chicago doing Second City or the Upright Citizens Brigade or improvisation with Del Close, when I went to SNL, all the stuff we were doing was connected to what was going on in the world. Like, we were writing cold opens that were, you know, about Clinton, that were about Bush Senior, that were, you know, we were doing comedy that was always connected. I think people tend to think of comedy as living in this hermetically sealed box of good times. But if you look at the best comedy, and I would just say from my own personal point of view, I love movies like Office Space and Idiocracy, Stripes, Dr. Strangelove, The Producers. I mean, these are all movies that could not be as great as they are without connecting to the world. I mean, I don't think anyone's had a sharper hand when it comes to criticizing the American grind than Mike Judge. So then you look at the stand-up comics, and it's the same thing. It's Chris Rock, it's Jim Gaffigan, who is routinely poking holes and kind of the advertising BS that we all live around. People don't think of him as political, but he is. And before his fall, Louis C.K., George Carlin, of course, Richard Pryor. It's always political. It's always social. Dick Gregory is a guy who went from comedy to straight up political activism. So I think that separation isn't there as much as we think it is. This is always stuff I've been engaged with that I've cared about, you know, going back to even the terrible stand-up comedy that I did in the 80s when I was in college.
Do clips of that exist somewhere, or is this just now all tapes have been burned?
There's one VHS tape that I have at home that will never be shown to anyone. I was okay. I did work a little bit. I did, you know, I emceed and occasionally middled, but I was lucky enough to get to work with some really great comics like Paul F. Tompkins, Keith Robinson. I was in Philly in the 80s. Stand-up was blowing up, but I was C-minus at best. I was not a great stand-up.
I'm going to ask about it later. My favorite stand-up right now is Sebastian Maniscalco, by the way. That guy just does it for me. He hits all the buttons.
Oh, I don't know him. I got to check him out.
Oh, my God. It's physical comedy, too. Like, it's fantastic.
Oh, great.
Now, what you're good at, I think particularly good at, I think, is you take a lot of these disparate facts and information and you process it, and then you create a narrative around it that explains it in a way that people can understand. And this is something that I've tried to do myself. When my writing went from, you know, fiction stuff to just talking about Trump all the time. And it's really inspiring to watch you do it like on this grand scale in movies. And I am hoping that one of these years you take on the whole Trump-Russia thing and you make a movie about it. So have you thought about doing that? And if not, can you please think about it?
God, Trump is funny because Trump to me is like trying to do a piece about a dangerous volcano, but the volcano is already erupted and it's raining down lava on you while you're trying to write it. So you know, I think doing something about Trump is like, hey, we got to be careful. Someone's going to shoot us in the stomach with a shotgun, but we've already been shot and then we're trying to write the piece. So to me, Trump is like post effect. He's already, the rash is on your skin. I know I'm using like five analogies here, but yeah, I don't like, once Trump takes hold, and thank God we got him out of there, although Biden has not been great, but thank God we got him out of there. We needed a little bit of a pause. Once that takes hold, you're into a different era. So I don't know. I don't know if there's anything to be done. I worked with producing a radio play with Tim Robbins that was about Trump that was pretty funny, but I don't know. I don't know how to get my head around him. To me, he's like falling down the stairs. Like, why has no one ever written a piece about falling down the stairs? It happens to everyone. And you're like, well, yeah, but like the game's over at that point.
I think that auxiliary characters would fit in your take on the auxiliary characters, the Paul Manafort's and the Flynn's and these like Giuliani. Even Giuliani is so ridiculous at this point.
Well, Giuliani, oh my God, I he's the most. I mean, I was in New York when he was mayor. I was writing for SNL, and good Lord, he was a train wreck back then. I mean, he was a bad guy.
Yeah.
And then to see him get worse, I didn't know that could, it's like watching a zombie rot. And you're like, at some point, the bones are going to collapse and the zombie won't work anymore. And it's like, no, he's still going. I mean, my thing is like, no doubt about it. Like, you know, Trump and this kind of extremist right wing that we're dealing with right now is a major dangerous problem, but I do think we give the sad sack Democrats too much of a break, and I think we forget that every day they're taking in donor checks, every day they're finding a wonderful new way to tank against this really frightening extreme right wing. And so I'm trying, the script I'm writing right now is trying to unify those theories, because the truth is the working class is not wrong. Like the Democrats abandoned them back in the 90s with Clinton. I mean, with the most favored nation status, with China, with NAFTA, GATT, everyone knew what that was going to do. And yet all these supposed smart people told us, no, you're going to save 20% on oscillating fans. But what they didn't ever tell us, which was like a duh, which is if you destroy industrial communities, fascism's going to rise out of it. And I think we're still stuck in that period where, yes, the extreme right wing is terrifying, utterly terrifying. But we give these corporate Democrats way too much latitude for their corruption and their lack of connection to the people. So, yeah, right now we have a system and an organism that is distinctly driving this country to the point of a breaking apart. So, yeah, the script I'm working on tries to take that all into account, which is the ultimate enemy is big, dirty money.
Which is the book I have behind me, by the way. Big Dirty Money.
That's, by the way, that's crazy. You really do. Can you take that off the shelf and hold it up?
Yeah. Have you read this book? Big Dirty Money. Not even kidding. Yeah. By Jen Taub. Fantastic book. You should read it. It's great.
Wow. Wow.
Yeah, just happened to be there facing out because we had her on our show on Friday. So yeah, okay, I'm going to pivot a little bit from the other stuff. So you're talking about the Democrat, and it's true. It's like, okay, the one party is, it's a two-party system. It's baked into our bylaws. So the idea that we could ever have more than two is just not going to happen. It would have already. But we have one whole party is just completely gone. It's just been completely taken over by fascists. And then the Democrats, I think a significant percentage of them either don't realize that or don't care. Schumer, you know, after we're recording this on May 31st, a week after the horror, the latest horrific school shooting in Uvalde, and Schumer just, you know, closed up the Senate and everybody went home. And
yep.
There just seems to be no urgency on the part of him and some of these guys. Do you think Biden is as bad? I don't. I feel like Biden, to some degree, has done a lot of good things and doesn't get the credit for it. But he also seems to be living in this fantasy world where Mitch McConnell is willing to compromise.
What has Biden done that's positive? I honestly can't think of one single thing. And it's not just Biden. It's the Congress. I think it's been a disaster. I think it's been the worst possible. Like what I voted for him, of course, because yep. Enough of the owl attacking our face that was Donald Trump every single day. So of course, I'm not a lunatic. I voted for him, but I have these worries, and I think it's been way worse than I ever imagined. It's just old, swampy, donor check addicted Democrats with no understanding or no, let's face it, no real desire to talk to the people. Their number one goal is not to activate a populist movement. And I think in our country, we forget that populism can be good. We've seen it before, the union movement in the 20s and 30s. Was incredibly productive. The civil rights movement through the 50s and 60s, the Gandhi's Indian independence movement, on and on and on. Populism can be really great. And the fact that the Democrats are so hell-bent on stopping any kind of populist energy completely defers it to the dark side of populism, which is, you know, race baiting, immigrant baiting, communist baiting, which the Republicans are just running with. So I think we have the exact wrong people in power. And I've considered writing an op-ed before. Like, I really think for the good of the nation, Schumer, Pelosi, Clyburn, on and on, should all resign. Like, I think they are killing this country. And I'm not exaggerating when I say that. I think they are doing great harm. And their reaction to the slaughter of those school children was a perfect example. Utterly clueless, just treated it like another week. And by the way, that's fine. You've been there a long time. Recognize it. Step aside. Yeah. Let new energy, let people with real emotions come into play, because right now, what we need is emotion. So no, I disagree with you. I think the Biden administration and the Congress has been a shocking disaster.
Interesting. I think the Congress has. I think, and the Senate in particular, this Manchin and Sinema stuff, just horrible.
Well, I think that's a cop-out too. I think the Manchin Sinema stuff is the greatest sort of excuse, because if it wasn't them, there would be eight other people that would step up, block this stuff. It would be Coons. It would be, what's his name? Angus.
Angus be, Young, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
No, no. Angus King. Angus Young is AC/DC. Okay.
Angus King. By the way, God bless Angus Young. I'm sorry I brought his name in this context. We've seen it in the past. There's always that dem that takes the fall in the purple state, whether it was Max Baucus, whether it was Joe Lieberman, whatever. We've seen this. It's like a three-card money game. It's like, well, that person won. That person is Joe Lieberman. That person is Joe Manchin. And they lure us in and they give us an excuse. But I'm actually seeing promising signs of late. I'm really seeing people start to get the con that we're caught in right now between these two parties, between the party of not the Democrats and not the Republicans, where only big money wins. And you know, I saw Pelosi actually say to a reporter, no, Congress people should be allowed to do insider trading. And when I saw that, I knew that they're letting their guard down, and that's a mistake. People are getting pissed.
People are definitely getting pissed. You had an interesting tweet a couple of days ago about the Princeton study in 2014, which I wasn't aware of. And you wrote, the famous Princeton study from 14 showing that people's will has near zero effect on what government does and what outcomes are almost entirely driven by big money and private interest groups is the skeleton key that explains everything going on in America right now. And I hadn't thought about it in quite that way before, because maybe it's wishful thinking. I feel like I have to put my faith in some of these people, or else I'll be buying houses in Ireland. I don't know.
No, you don't. No, you don't. You do not have to. You have to be realistic about the fact that it's all donor checks, dark money, super PACs, totally runs.
So, okay, but like, what do we do about it? Because the Senate is so, the structure, the underlying structure of the Senate almost prevents any major changes from happening, because it's obviously was created to give the slave states an unfair advantage, and it continues to do that.
Well, you're right. There's a flaw baked in, but let's face it, it's the filibuster, which is a recent invention, really screwed the whole thing up. And, you know, by the way, there are people that have written beautiful books about this, like Jane Mayer with Dark Money, Kim Phillips Fain with Invisible Hands, Kurt Anderson, Evil Geniuses, Nancy McLean, Democracy in Chains. These are all books that must be read to understand what's going on. So I think the number one thing is we just got to get out of this pinball machine of bouncing from Team Red to Team Blue.
Yeah.
And we got to start looking at corruption in naked, quantifiable terms, because it keeps happening over and over. I'm 54, and my entire life has been voting for the lesser of two evils.
Yeah.
My entire life. And it has not worked. We've gotten lower and lower and lower. So I would just throw this out to anyone that's hearing this that is like, oh, Mr. Progressive Democratic Socialist Adam McKay, like, can you deny that? It hasn't worked. It's been disastrous. The country is, so why not try something else? And you know, the big thing, the big muscular move we need to do is just veer towards primaries. And we need to realize there's a lot of money that's trying to vilify progressives and democratic socialists, who are the only people in our political sphere who aren't bought and paid for. So we need to fight the information warfare that's going on and counteract that. And I do think the number one way to do that is awareness. I think just saying it, demonstrating it, talking about it, the more of us that talk about it, I'm starting to see a new anger rise up off this recent massacre. And I think we owe it to all these people that have died. Nearly 750,000 people have died from guns since 9/11. And we don't have the exact estimates, but probably around 500,000 to 750,000 from opioid ODs, not even to get into the amount of people that are dying from lack of nationalized healthcare. So we're talking millions of dead people here. And it is high time we break out of our brand loyalty and start thinking differently.
I think this is good, but I get just how? Like, what's the first thing to do? Like, how? What do we do? Because I see it like, and I agree. Like, my son asked me, he's 17. Like, what do you? I think Biden's the best president of my lifetime. And he said, why?
Jesus.
No, you don't think so. But Jesus. I went through the thing. But again,
that is the craziest statement I've ever heard. You have to explain yourself.
There haven't been that many good. Well, okay. Here's what he's done. and a lot of what he's done is in terms of in relationship to the damage that Trump wrought. Okay. He got everybody vaccinated quickly.
Oh, no, he didn't. We're at 65%. It's
that's but that's people choosing not to is not his fault. He can he can't.
That is BS. I think here's the big respectfully, of course.
That's fine. No.
Yeah, yeah. Here's the big thing Democrats never use. And it's like the Washington Generals losing to the Harlem Globetrotters.
Okay.
Like they always find a way. And the thing they never use is the bully pulpit and communication and correct. I've been involved years ago when I still believed the Democratic Party actually was trying. I wrote speeches. I participated in these groups. They are not interested. And you can give a speech to rally America. Senators can give a speech. There are ways to communicate directly. They are not interested. Their number one job of the Democratic Party is to keep populist energy down. Biden has utterly failed when it comes to vaccines. The numbers are the lowest among any, like you look at the list we're on, it's with like Kazakhstan, like Burkina Faso. I mean, it's a horrendous list that we're on.
But he can't force somebody to get vaccinated. So I think he did that.
Why vote for him then? Like, what's it matter? I mean, like if Biden is so powerless and the Congress is so powerless, then what's the point? Like, I mean,
well, there's also foreign affairs stuff.
Like what?
Putin invaded Ukraine and he took 3 weeks and put NATO back together and the Western Alliance back together, which is meaningful. And I feel like he's been, for me, this is an important issue for me personally, this Putin is bad thing. I do think Biden's done a good job with that. But
boy, that is a low bar. I mean, that is like, I mean,
well, Trump's, not when you consider the people before. Trump was actively
enabling the whole thing. Right. It's why I
Obama let Putin take the Crimea in 14. Like you can go back in time and look at these places. But to your point from before, there haven't been very many good presidents in my lifetime. Richard Nixon did a lot of really good things before Watergate. And Richard Nixon's list of accomplishments stack up with anybody we've had since then. And that's horrible, right? So,
but that gets back to the populist will of the people.
Yeah.
Because that wasn't Richard Nixon. I mean, if Richard Nixon had had his way, he would have gone right away to a totalitarian state. He was a paranoid lunatic.
Right.
But America as a wide swath was, you know, this was way more progressive. So to be right wing at that time still meant that you signed the bill for food stamps, still meant that you, you know, he had a bunch of things.
He created the EPA. Evil Geniuses has a whole chapter about all this stuff that he did.
Yeah. So, I mean, and same with Ronald Reagan. People like to do the game of look at Ronald Reagan's term. He's more progressive. No.
No, Reagan was
Ronald Reagan would have jailed all of us. I mean,
That's unambiguously horrific. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think you're right. Like, yes, people need to be making speeches. But sometimes I feel like part of the issue with the messaging is that the media doesn't report the damn message. The media is so concerned with horse races and stuff. But you say,
I agree. The media has been captured by big money in a lot of ways. But look at what Steve Kerr did for the Golden State Warriors. I haven't seen any Democrat come anywhere near that. Murphy from Connecticut, a little bit. What's his name from Beto O'Rourke from Texas? A little bit.
Yeah, Kerr sounded as great politically as anybody has, note for note.
100%. And that doesn't mean that Steve Kerr should be the next president. But what it means is we need human beings in there who aren't worn down by the grind of donor checks and polls and consultants. I mean, it's a toxic, removed environment in D.C. that crosses red and blue lines. So, I do. I think all of our energy should go to fighting information warfare, advertising, perception, what your friend says, and we should be looking at primaries and getting corporate Dems out of there so we can have a viable opposition party, which right now we clearly do not. I apologize if I'm a little fired up.
I prefer fired up. I prefer fired up. You know, that's what we like. This is a show people are listening to for information and entertainment. It's good. We like fired up. You mentioned all the dark money and the donor check. This is something that no one has been able to really explain to me. And I don't know if you know, but I'm going to ask you anyway. When people give money to these campaigns, like if Ted Cruz gets money from the NRA, how much of that money can he just take? Because it feels like sometimes people think, oh, they're just giving them the money directly. And obviously he can't like pay his mortgage with it. And yet there seems to be some of it that he can, like maybe he can just go buy clothes and cars and whatever and just expense it all. Like I haven't had a good explainer on how that works.
Well, I don't know how many of your listeners know about the recent Supreme Court decision that just came down, which essentially said, because in the past, you couldn't spend a dime of it. Like it was all for your campaign. It had to be accounted for. And I think it was Ted Cruz, right, that went to the Supreme Court because he was playing games with loans with this money. It started to get a little hazy. And of course, our Supreme Court, which is a train wreck, gave him the decision. But in the past, it used to be, no, it all had to be accounted for. It all lived in its own box. But that's definitely changing. It's amazing. If you think about that 2014 Princeton study that showed that essentially the will of the people
is
has no effect on the policy decisions, the bills that are signed in DC. What's so strange to me is that the press never covers it except to say which presidential candidate has raised more money, like it's a good thing. And so it definitely, the two bounce off each other in the sense that because there's no press coverage, there's no pressure on the candidates or the serving Congress people to be accountable at all. And it's really kind of a death spiral.
Well, the press has done, I mean, the last, especially since 2015, it's just been atrocious. Everybody listening to this is tired of hearing me talk about it, but that all they care about is poll numbers, horse races, and you know, something happened with what the Kevin McCarthy texts were released, for example, and all the press could talk about was, is this going to affect his chances to be speaker? And it's like, who gives a shit? Biden's poll numbers in May of a non-presidential election year are meaningless. It doesn't matter what the poll numbers are. Like, write about what's happening. There's so much to write about. There's so much to cover. And the Times in particular is so confounding because they do really great stuff. And then just horrible things for 85% of the time. And the op-eds are usually horrible.
Horrendous. I mean, I've criticized the press a lot. I always make a point of saying there are some really good journalists out there who are doing incredible work. So it's everything nowadays is a broad brush. But in general, I was talking to my oldest daughter about the idea, like, if you wanted to go to college, you know, she's in college, but I was like, if you ever wanted to write a PhD, you know, your dissertation, I would do it on the hundreds of ways that any system or institution can be captured by big money, or the psychology of corruption, because I'm always reminded, do you remember the Philip K. Dick short story where a guy is being chased because they're like, you're not a guy, you're a bomb. And the guy, and you're with the guy from his point of view. And you're like, this is crazy. Like, this guy's a guy. Like, what are you doing? And you're rooting for him to get away. And the very end of the story is just a detonation. And I feel like that's the press. I feel like a lot of the people that are a part of it are like, what are you talking about? I'm doing my job. And you're like, you don't get it. You were chosen for this job. The structure around you. And, you know, we got a tremendous amount of anger with Don't Look Up because of that. And always the answer was like, look, I'm sure you're a lovely person, but you're involved in a system that is broken and is self-selecting. So
Okay, on the topic of Don't Look Up, I loved it. I watched it twice the weekend it dropped. And then I find like I can barely have an attention span for anything. But when I really like something, I need to watch it twice. It's weird. The second time I watched it with my 15-year-old and we're watching and he's really into it. And then at a certain point, he looks at me, he's like, wait, the asteroid isn't really going to hit the Earth, is it? It was like, because I see all the sort of, oh shit.
At what point did he ask that? I'm dying to know.
I think they were in Lansing at that point. Maybe they were, once Chalamet showed up. The casting, by the way, putting all these like Gen Z touchstone actors in there was really, really a good idea. So, you know, the demographics were very wide on it. And I think part of the thing about it with the satire is that I think everybody watched it. I don't think it was something that just like, you know, leftists watched. I think everybody watched that movie trying to figure it out, which, you know, in satire, I think is really important. I've been talking about that on the last couple of podcasts. My friend Ryan Byrne was on, we were talking about satire, and he said comedy is really one of the few ways where you can penetrate that bubble, you know, where you can go into the enemy territory and you start making jokes and you have at least a little bit of leeway, you know, before they realize that they're being made fun of or whatever. And it's a weird time for satire. I feel like some satire, like more traditional stuff that would fly before, like there's that account, the birds aren't real guy, who's just, he pretends to be. I think it's funny, but I also think it confuses people. And I don't know that this is the time for that. I don't know. What's your take on the state of satire right now, just in general?
That's a great question. You know, we've struggled with that in the editor room on Don't Look Up, my editor, Hank Corwin, and I. The original cut of the movie was way more leaning towards satire and drama. And we were screening the movie. I like to do screenings with audiences, and they were engaging with it. But I had a moment where I realized this has to be a populist movie. Like, we have to actually unleash the laughs. And keep in mind, when I say that, I don't mean everyone's going to laugh. I'm sure there's someone who just heard that and like, it wasn't funny, but like, comedy is subjective, but in general, when you screen it for audiences, you can tell when they're connecting with it in a wry smile way, which is kind of satire, or they're mm-hmm. laughing out loud, which is comedy. So at one point we shifted gears on that movie and I was like, we're gonna make it a comedy. And I even joked with my editor, I was like, you know this means we will get mixed reviews. You know this means we will not win awards. Like, and he was like, oh, I don't know about that. I was like, Hank Corwin, my editor, I was like, I've been through this a lot. Trust me, once you shift gears to comedy. But I told him, I said, the thing with it is, it's going to expand the movie in a way that is times 10. And sure enough, that's what happened. It was amazing to watch once the movie premiered on Netflix. It just shot through the stratosphere. It was number one in like 90 countries. It ended up with like 300-400 million viewers. It was, I've never had an experience like it. I've done a lot of movies, a lot of TV shows. And that movie, it was really actually kind of heartening for me at that particular time to see people in Nigeria, people in Vietnam, people in Pakistan, like respond to this movie in a way that was like, yes, I know what that is. And then on top of all of that, to see the climate community, the climate activists really feel like they were seen. That was really incredible. But your question is spot on. It was always the question of satire versus comedy. And it's a very gray line between the two. Like, I'm not sure if Mike Judge is comedy or satire. I think he combines the two. And ultimately, that's what we tried to do with the movie. We tried to combine the two to engage the audience more.
I think that's a fair assessment. And your little definition of satire as wry smile and comedy as laugh out loud is very good. I wrote that totally answers it answers the question without answering the question of what is it and how is it defined. I find that I think the first time I saw Idiocracy, like when it came out or whatever, I laughed out loud a lot. Now when you watch it, it's much less laugh out loud funny. It's almost horrible to watch it because President Camacho is actually a good president in the context of that hellscape. He is one of the smartest people on the planet, you know, and Trump was not. So, you know,
Camacho is willing to recognize another intelligent person.
Yes.
And give them some authority. You're 100% right. We actually, my wife and I had, you know, I love Mike Judge. I met him once in Austin. I was just like, borderline bowing down. He's one of my favorites of all time. And when that movie was coming out, I was like, where is the, why isn't this movie in any theaters? Yeah, and we found it at the old, the people in LA will know this theater, the old Avco theater over on the near west side. And my wife and I went and saw it in a theater, which was hard to do.
Yeah, we didn't.
We were like 18 people in the crowd. And oh my God, we cackled like Gibbons the entire time. It was so, and you're 100% right. You watch it now, it ain't so funny.
it feels like, especially my favorite scene is where they're in the cabinet meeting and David Herman plays the guy and he's like, you know, why do you say Carl's Jr.? And he's like, because I get paid every time I do. If you were so smart, you would know that, which of course, there's no way he could know that. It's so dumb and it's so good. Yeah, no, but I think, you know, with Don't Look Up, I mean, you really did hit all the notes, like you said, but also while it was obviously ostensibly about climate change, it could easily be read about other things. At the time that I saw it, I was reading, you could read the vaccine and the anti-vax stuff into it. I read into it very much the descent into fascism and the sense that we're hurtling towards this place where after a certain point, there will be no ability to return from it. And so for me, that it felt very immediate. Like I felt like, you know, just trying to shout about Trump and fascism and all this stuff for years, I felt very much at home at the dinner table at the end of the movie. And I really like when she says, at least we tried. That was the best. It makes me tear up thinking about it. It's really, really good. Yeah.
I mean, that's the way, you know, what we realized because we made, you know, I wrote the movie before COVID, but for, you know, God, my God, like 20, 25 years, and there's lots of people that have been doing this, but we've all been waving our arms saying we are headed down the wrong track. And we've all been met with eye rolls and friends telling us to relax. And there's been a lot of sort of forks in the road along that journey. So I totally agree with you. I think it's the same energy as the fact that America is on a cliff right now, that the climate is on a cliff. I mean, everyone thinks the climate is 100 years from now. No, it's like 8 years from now. Like
yeah,
we're in that kind of zone. And COVID, science denial, inequality, I think all of those things line up. We're sort of losing civilization at this point. And when you clue into that, you feel crazy when the people around you sort of tell you to relax. I think that's a totally valid interpretation, 100%.
The Rylance character, the tech guy, is just the best possible combination of all of those awful guys that we put so much faith and trust in. That performance is really just out of this world. I mean, there's a lot of good ones in that movie, but that guy in particular, geez, unbelievable.
I agree. Yeah. I agree. That was the hardest character to create in the movie because the real guys are so bizarre and twisted and broken. And my cheat code on that was hire one of the 10 best actors on planet Earth and collaborate with them. And my God, I thought it was fantastic. That combination of sort of you know, agoraphobia and superiority that he found was just perfect.
Oh, it was really good. It was stunning. And you did hire, you have Meryl Streep, and even in one of the scenes, your Secretary of Education is Allison Weller, who I went to high school with. And she was a senior when I was a freshman, and she is an amazing actor. And I felt like, yeah, you belong in the room with Meryl Streep, damn it. So it vindicated my own personal sense of the barometer of who's a good actor and who isn't. So, you know, for what it's worth. So on the topic of your work, now I have to ask this, you're an executive producer on Succession, right? Is that what you're, okay. So that to me, that's with apologies to Slippin' Jimmy and Kim Wexler and Lalo, that's the best show on TV that's actively on TV right now. What is your involvement with Succession? What do you just have your imprimatur on it? Do you look over the scripts? What do you do? How much credit can you claim?
I'm going to give all credit to Jesse Armstrong, because he wrote, you know, he with his incredible writing staff, they write all of these episodes and then amazing directors. But I'll give myself a tiny bit of credit, which is early on, I saw that pilot script, and my producer, Kevin Masick, who's also a producer on it, gave me the script. And we've known Jesse for a long time, years before that. And I read it and I was just like, this is one of the best scripts I've read. I would kill to direct this pilot. So the fun thing with directing a pilot, and we just had this with our Lakers show, Winning Time, is you get to be a major, you know, you collaborate with the writer and you get to be a major part of casting it. As the director, I get to, you know, create the look. I get to create the tone. I brought in Nick Bertel. So it's really, I love doing pilots for shows because you really get to collaborate. You really get to set the tone. And then it's incredibly enjoyable to see the show sort of roll along with hopefully some of the cobblestones you've laid for it to walk on. So I love doing pilots. And same with Winning Time. You know, I got to...
Well, I want to talk about that too. So, yeah.
Set the look and do the casting, which was the hardest casting I've ever been involved in.
Yeah.
And so with Succession, it's great. And I read the scripts and I give notes on the cuts and I check in with Jesse. And every year I pitch ideas. I've gotten a few through, but I'm always like, Jesse, you protect your writer's room. And it's been a joy to, you know, in any way to support this idea that we're going to depict these, you know, this congealed wealth, the inherited wealth, the dynastic wealth behind these families, and especially families that can, you know, have a large impact on our media, and to show it in a way that's not glorifying it, that in fact kind of shows how screwed up it is. And yet at the same time we're engaged, it's been one of the more enjoyable, satisfying experiences I've ever had. But that was kind of my involvement and still is. Tomorrow I'm going to read the first script for the first episode and give notes on it.
Look at you. What a great, I tend to think of these prestige shows in tiers, and that's like a tier one. There's not that many tier one shows, but Succession is absolutely unequivocally a tier one.
I like that we got to tier one. I'll take it.
It's tier one. So you mentioned Winning Time, I enjoy the hell out of Winning Time. That feels more like one of your projects. It's got the kind of the stylistic things that I associate with you, like characters talking to the audience and like kind of, you know, random things being written on the screen and very specific period details and kind of going out of your way to explaining this, that, or the other. For people who don't know, it's called Winning Time. It's about the Showtime Lakers. The book is called Showtime. And it occurred to me that it's probably not called Showtime because it's on HBO and HBO doesn't want to promote a show called Showtime. Is that true?
Is correct.
Yes.
That
okay. I thought so.
It is correct.
The show is about the Showtime Lakers. The first season is Magic Johnson's rookie year, basically, from he's drafted, he's in Michigan, he comes in, which again, the point of entry character is Magic Johnson, which is fantastic. And it's based on true stuff, but it's all kind of exaggerated in a really, I think, super fun way. I'm a basketball guy and I loved it. My wife doesn't care, could care less about sports. She also really enjoyed it. She likes all the period stuff and the characters and this and that. And I think you mentioned the casting, but I think you did a great job casting. Like, everybody knows what Magic Johnson looks like. That actor, he looks like Magic Johnson. I think you didn't travel too far to get the guy who played Norm Nixon. You just got Norm Nixon's kid. Good idea with that. And the Kareem guy. Now, do you like lower the rims to do the basketball shots and shoot it in such a way to make them look taller? Because the basketball sequences look pretty good. They look real to me.
Yeah, in some cases, we lower them. In the case of Solomon Hughes, who plays Kareem, he's a real professional basketball player. So he's 6'11".
Oh, he is. Okay.
Yeah. And okay. He's also a doctor. But I got to tell you, that was the craziest casting, the most difficult casting I have ever been involved with in my entire life. And tons of love and respect to Francine Maisler and her team for the work they did. We found these actors. They were, Quincy Isaiah, who plays Magic, Solomon Hughes, who plays Kareem. Those were the two most difficult. And these were, Solomon Hughes had never acted before. Quincy,
really?
Never had acted before. And Quincy had done some stuff, but was kind of new. So we got very, very lucky with that. And then we also got lucky that a lot of these actors could play ball, like Devon, who's Norm Nixon's kid, is a good ball player. Like Quincy, he trained, he worked with our basketball coach, Adon, but he could play ball. So we got very, very lucky. It took a lot of work. The only one we're taking crap for that we missed on was Dr. J. The gentleman we cast looked a little too old for Dr. J, but he was good. He was a really good actor.
Yeah, he was.
Our Larry Bird was amazing.
Oh my God, he's so good.
Right, right. And it was really fun. And I'm a huge Hoophead. And this was always kind of like a dream project for me to like go into that period, which I lived through, where the NBA sprung to life. A lot of people don't know that it used to be like the fifth, sixth, seventh most popular sport in the 70s, behind like baseball, football, college ball, college football, yeah. Boxing, golf. Like, it was crazy. And so it was so cool to get into this story. And not only that, to show how Magic Johnson and the Showtime Lakers really kind of transformed American culture. That was really the first time where Black culture became American culture. And I remember living through it as a kid.
I really enjoyed the hell out of the show, like I said. I also think, I know that you guys are taking guff from Jerry West, by the way Jerry West is portrayed. I have to say, I don't know if he's watched the whole show. I fucking love Jerry West on the show. I love Jerry West anyway. I know what he did as a general manager of the Lakers. I know he got the Shaq and Kobe crew together and all this stuff, but he's great on the show. Every time he shows up, it's like, he's wonderful. I don't understand. Like, I guess I understand.
We all worship Jerry West. He's like our favorite. He's like an idol. Same with Kareem. Same with Magic. All these guys. I mean, these are the guys we grew up worshiping. You know, Jerry just said, I think like 3 weeks ago, that he's never seen an episode.
Oh, he's got to watch it. Yeah.
I think some people wound him up because if you look at what we're showing, and a lot of it's from his own autobiography, he was miserable when he was coaching. He was breaking golf clubs. He was yelling at people. And then when he stepped away from coaching, he found his niche, which was being a GM. And he's one of the great GMs, one of the great players of all time, not to mention the fact that he's someone who spoke openly, who speaks openly about their issues with mental health. So, no, we admire the heck out of Jerry West, but it's clear someone wound him up. I don't know who it was, because we're like,
watch the show. Same with Kareem. Like, Kareem, we love you. You're a legend. You're one of the smartest, most insightful, political, arguably the greatest player ever. But at the same time, I also get it. It's weird to see your life depicted. Of course, it's not exactly like how it happened. We're dramatizing. So I get it. Loads of respect to all those guys.
I also love Adrian Brody's Pat Riley is just, I can't even, you know. Are you a Lakers fan or are you or something else?
I'm a Sixers fan.
You're a Sixers fan. Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
I grew up around Philly. Well, as a little kid, I grew up outside Boston.
Yeah.
Outside, I was in Worcester, so I used to have a thick Worcester accent. And then I moved to Philly around fourth grade. And so that's kind of the team I hooked on to. And but I'm just a hoops fan. I'll watch any two teams play. I'll watch we used to go to high school games when I was in Chicago. I saw Kevin Garnett play in high school, Ronnie Fields. I've seen amazing players in high school. So I just love basketball. I'm a total lousy player, but I play all the time. I don't care. I'm D plus at best. But we love it. I'm a Sixers fan, but I remember the impact that the Showtime Lakers had, and it was massive.
The reason I asked if you're a Lakers fan, because Jeannie Buss is right now just, I don't know what she's doing, but I'm a Knicks fan, so I have no cause Lakers won like 2 years ago. So but even we know, you got to stop listening to Phil Jackson. Phil Jackson doesn't know what he's talking about managing, you know, like he doesn't know how
you
to assemble
can't
a team.
Judge anything as a Knicks fan. You have no right to criticize. You can't criticize Poison Ivy. You have to be like, you know what? Poison Ivy is going pretty well because the Knicks are the biggest train wreck in sports. However, I disagree with you. I thought their hire of Darvin Ham was a great hire as head coach.
Oh, yeah, that's true. That's true.
Yeah, I thought that was really good. So I'm hoping, you know, because the NBA is healthier when the Lakers are good. And I want to see LeBron have one last run. So I'm hoping that Darvin Ham decision was the first of a bunch of good moves they're going to make. But yeah, no, I'm a hoops junkie, man. I'm here in Ireland and I've been staying up to like 4:30 in the morning to watch the playoffs on my phone. And I just can't help it.
Who do you got? You got the Warriors or Celtics? Who do you have?
I go Warriors. They're deep as hell. I mean, they really have two squads on that team. I love the kid Kuminga they got in the draft. I love their bench. I mean, the fact that they have, really, if you look at it, their fifth best player is Andrew Wiggins, who's an all-star.
Former number one overall pick.
It's a crazy, crazy team.
Now, I don't know. Boston, such a weird team. This is how pathetic it is to be a Knicks fan. I feel like when we beat them, when RJ Barrett beat them in that game, that was the game that woke the Celtics up, and they've been amazing since then. So I feel like the Knicks, basically, if the Celtics won, it would be like the Knicks won because we kicked their ass every time we played them this year. So
that is, I got to tell you, Greg, that is sad. That is the saddest thing I've ever heard. That's like saying, you know, a guy like bumped my shoulder and I was too afraid to retaliate. And then later that guy beat another guy up. So it's like I beat him up.
We have to take our pride where we can. You know, we did make the playoffs last year. It was so exciting. I had forgotten to be nervous to watch a playoff game. I had forgotten what that feels like because it's been so long.
You know? I want the Knicks to be good so badly. I mean, I was in New York, you know, because I was at Saturday Night Live. So I was there through the mid 90s into the early 2000s. And I remember the grandmama 4-point play.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember Allen Houston, and we used to go to games, Latrell Sprewell, and it was really electric. So, I mean, I still really believe Madison Square Garden is the capital of basketball. So I'm always rooting for them, but my God, I'm just confused by what they constantly do.
The last 2 years have been, we're okay now, but you mentioned the Larry Johnson shot. I watched that in my apartment on East 28th Street, which was kind of not on the same parallel as MSG, but far away. And I swear when that shot went in, I could feel it. I could feel the ground shake. I'm not even joking. It was amazing. I was by myself alone on a little TV and I could feel it physically. That's how excited the fans were.
I was with my wife. We lived on East 6th Street between 2nd and Bowery, right up from that Indian restaurant row. And for some reason, the second it happened, I went and opened the window and you could hear people screaming all around the city. It was one of the coolest Hoops moments I can ever remember. No, I it was incredible.
Yeah.
We need that again. We definitely do.
It's coming. It's coming. We've got the Obi Toppin dunks. We've got, I don't know.
They got to play Toppin though. They got to give him minutes. I don't love Tibbs. I really don't. I don't think he's the right coach for that team. Like, we need someone to open that offense up, play Toppin
quickly.
Crazy that he wouldn't play him last year. And then when he finally had to, he played great.
I know. This is the lament of all the Knicks fans. At least we have good players. For a long time, we didn't even have good players. We had bad coaches and bad players. Now, at least we can blame Tibbs when things don't go well. You know, it's a thing that we can do.
A good draft pick this year too. Not bad. 11th pick.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. We got number 11.
You get that point guard out of Kentucky. Maybe like you'll get someone.
Yeah. Ty. Maybe we'll get, I don't know. I'm hoping we trade up and get that Shaden Sharp. I've heard good things about him, but I don't know.
Oh, that would be a smart move too. Yeah.
Actually, we'll trade the pick and Julius Randle to the Lakers for LeBron, even up. Ask your, what has Kareem given you guys guff about winning time too or no?
He did. Yeah. He wrote an op-ed. I can't remember for which trade it was for. I think he writes for like Variety or Hollywood Reporter. And his big thing was he watched half the episode and he said the show was boring. And I was like, well, I mean, one thing I know is it's definitely not boring.
No, it's not. It's not boring.
But I, once again, I get it. It's your life. You know, I don't begrudge any of them for feeling weird or angry or like it's not right. And you know, not every single detail is historically accurate. We had to crunch storylines. We had to crunch the season. We had to create moments to kind of show what was happening. So I get it in their case. I still worship Kareem. I'm sure he wouldn't talk to me, but I still think he's the greatest of all time.
He's unassailable. And, you know, the longevity of the career, but he was great. The way Kareem is portrayed in the show, I think is really great.
Oh, I if he had kept watching, we treated him with nothing but respect. The fifth episode, which is kind of the Kareem episode.
Yeah, that's really good.
Is one of my favorite episodes of the season. You really see the complexity of Kareem and what he was trying to deal with and how he was trying to find his voice. A lot of credit to Rodney Barnes, one of our writers who took the lead on that episode. I thought it was a beautiful episode. It's called Pieces of a Man off the Gil Scott Heron song. And I just love it. Beautifully done.
It was. Yeah, that's one of the highlight episodes for sure. I like that. And this is, I think, a very Adam McKay thing. When you introduce Kareem, one of the first times you see him, he's doing the scene from Airplane with the kid. And the.
Oh, yeah. Oh yeah, legendary.
You know what? This is a good, because I know we're coming up on time, and I know you're busy, so I don't want to keep you too long. Here's a good question to end with: Kareem's performance, the real Kareem in Airplane, is of course astonishingly wooden and awful, almost, which is what makes it funny. I think the best like athlete turned acting performance ever is Garnett in Uncut Gems. I think he's amazing in it. He's so believable. Who do you think is has the best acting performance for like a former?
Oh, really good question. All right, so I'm going to say this. I'm going to say Hill Street Blues. And I'm going to say Mike Warren, who was the point guard from UCLA back when UCLA was the dynasty. And what was his name? The football player, too, who was on that show. Was really good as well. But that show had two really successful athletes playing roles where you never even thought, oh, they used to be an athlete. They were so good in that. But wait, let me see if I can beat that. I mean, Ray Allen's pretty good and he's got game. I'm kind of with you on the Garnett.
I couldn't believe how good he was.
By the way, that's one of my favorite, Uncut Gems is one of my favorite top 10 movies of the last 10 years.
So, I agree.
I think totally. I'm with you, but otherwise I would go with Warren. I think his name was Ed Marinara. That was his name.
Okay.
And he was a Heisman Trophy candidate from Cornell. And the two of them were in that show and they were incredible. They were so real. I'm trying to think of any others. Do you remember a movie called Inside Moves?
No.
Oh, you have a treat coming your way.
Okay, I'm writing this down.
John Savage is the lead. David Morse is in it. There's a bunch of great actors, and there's a ton of cameos from the Golden State Warriors of that era. I think Robert Parrish is in it. You can't call any of them acting performances, but it's an excuse to highlight a forgotten gem, Inside Moves. I love that movie.
Okay, Inside Moves. And of course, Jim Brown is a good actor too. Jim Brown in Dirty Dozen and in Mars Attacks, maybe. I don't know.
But is
not,
he?
I don't know. He's not like Garnett. The Garnett, if Garnett isn't good, like they were going to make Uncut Gems and put Kobe in it. I loved Kobe. Kobe was not a good actor. Have to believe what Garnett's saying or the entire movie won't work.
So I have the winner. Rick Fox and Oz. That's the winner.
Yeah, Rick Fox.
He was amazing.
Yeah,
he was amazing. By the way, Rick Fox. Although I'm telling you, Ed Marinara and I'm getting their names wrong, and Warren from Hill Street Blues, really good. But that aside, it's Rick Fox. Rick Fox is the best ex-athlete actor, in my opinion. And Oz, it's a TV show. It's not a movie.
Right, but still, it counts. We'll allow it. I don't think I ever saw. I don't like things about prison. I think in my past life I was in prison, and I don't like to watch, things about prison.
I kind of know what you mean. Oz was a tough show, but there's incredible acting performances, and Rick Fox is unbelievable.
Okay, I believe you. Since you've cast all these things so fucking well. Even like Steve Carell as Rumsfeld,
so good.
I don't know that ever would have occurred to me. It works so well. Okay, so the new thing that you're working on doesn't have a title yet or anything like that, and it's going to be a while, right? We don't want to talk about it yet.
No. Yeah, well, there's two things. One has already been announced. It's called Uninhabitable Earth. It's an anthology, sort of Black Mirror style show for HBO. I'm here writing that. And then there's a script I'm writing, a feature film script that spec script. I haven't shown it to anyone. So I'm working on that. And that kind of a little bit addresses what we were talking about, which is, how our lives have been taken over by big money. And then the more exciting immediate thing is our company Hyper Object has a movie coming out. The trailer, I think, comes out tomorrow called The Menu with Ralph Fiennes and Anya Taylor-Joy. And then we have a documentary feature coming out with Billy Corbin on Hulu that's amazing. And then we just premiered a movie called The Holly at a film festival, which is incredible. If anyone ever gets a chance to see it, we're trying to get distribution for it. And then we're working on a new season of Succession, Winning Time. We do a show called Motherland, which is a wild imaginative show, and about five other things. So yeah.
You're a busy man. I really appreciate you taking time. This has been so much fun and a thrill for me because I kept my gushing, I think, in check, but I'm a big fan. I think you do great work and I want you to keep it up. I'm excited for all of these things. So, on Twitter, your Twitter handle is, what is it?
It's
Ghost Panther. What does that mean?
It means absolutely nothing. I signed on like 12 years ago and someone had Adam McKay And I just went, I'm going to make up a ridiculous name. So, and now 12 years or 14 years later, people constantly ask me, what is it? Nothing.
It means nothing. Okay, good. Because I thought you were going to say, well, obviously it's from this movie that I did, you know, to, how could you not know that? And good. Now I don't feel, I don't feel so dumb. So follow him on Twitter at Ghost Panther. I have no joke for Ghost Panther. Adam McKay, thank you so much. This was such a good time. Thank you.
Greg, thanks for having me on. I've known you through Twitter for a bunch of years and absolute pleasure, man.
Thank you.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sofia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kanai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW.